you are the judge of your own value and of what you bring to the table. And if you're not able, if you don't have limbs, so you can't go build PPEs for someone or build things, great, what else can you do? Like if you're deaf, if you're blind, if you're in a wheelchair, if you're like, it doesn't matter. All that matters is you did everything that you could do and you didn't take no for an answer trying to get there.
It's easy to talk about the successes, but what doesn't get talked about enough is the struggle. My name is Eric Weinmayer. I've gotten the chance to ascend Mount Everest, to climb the tallest mountain in every continent, to kayak the Grand Canyon, and I happen to be blind. It's been a struggle to live what I call a no-barriers life, to define it, to push the parameters of what it means. And part of the equation is diving into the learning process and trying to illuminate the universal elements that exist along the way. And that unexplored terrain between those dark places we find ourselves in and the summit exists a map. That map, that way forward, is what we call no barriers.
Welcome to another installment of our No Barriers Alchemy podcast series, where we explore this extraordinary moment in our lives. Special thanks to Wells Fargo and Prudential for their generous support of the series. Mick Ebeling has sparked a movement of pragmatic and inspirational innovation. Ebeling is a film, television, and commercial producer, philanthropist, technology trailblazer, author, and entrepreneur. Ebeling is CEO of Not Impossible, which is an organization that develops creative solutions to address real-world problems. One of their projects, the iWriter, is an open-source, low-cost DIY device that enables individuals with paralysis to communicate and create art using only the movement of their eyes. Time magazine named the iWriter one of the top 50 inventions of 2010. And the device is now part of the Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection. Ebeling's book, Not Impossible, The Art and Joy of Doing What Couldn't Be Done, recounts his life experiences and projects. Enjoy.
Mick, so you're a hard guy to describe, right? You are an entertainer, a storyteller, a speaker, an author. You dive into science and innovation and engineering. You're kind of like an orchestra leader, right? And so tell us, how have you always been like that, or is it something that you've learned over the years?
I think I've always been hungry for life. And I think that Not Impossible has just been a natural evolution for me in terms of, once I discovered the fact that technology is this kind of Excalibur sword that you can wield in a way that truly helps people. And it doesn't necessarily, you don't have to have these massive budgets to go do it. You can get scrappy and to at least get something to a prototype state of, phase and stage. That was just this kind of revelation. And I think that because of that, now I just like hanging out with people who are smarter than me and people that are just doing genius stuff, because I feel like every time we tackle one of our Not Impossible initiatives, we end up grabbing I personally grab a little bit more morsel of information that I can apply someplace else. And I think I'm sometimes probably annoying to the geniuses that I'm working with, because I'm asking so many questions all the time. But I think that's what has kind of led to, at least the kind of what drives me now, is just how do you aggregate a bunch of brilliant people and brilliant ideas to focus solving one problem for one person, and then use that to scale it out to help many people.
Deepak Chopra said that you were like a template for a new science, like a new kind of science of consciousness. I thought that was pretty heavy, but very cool, right? So did you always have that consciousness, or, you started out in the entertainment world, right? Doing like special effects and all that kind of stuff, right? And then you kind of had, did you have an epiphany, or was it a slow burn that you kind of thought, okay, I want to bring some ideas and solutions to the world?
Yeah, it was, I had an entertainment, my company was a production company. We made animation and design for films and television and commercials. So my exposure to technology was more on the creative side. And then one day my wife and I were exposed to a paralyzed graffiti artist named Tony Tempt Kwan. And we discovered he had ALS. And but what really appalled us is that he was unable to draw, unable to communicate, unable to do anything, where we ended up creating a thing called the iWriter. And the iWriter was a cheap pair of sunglasses from the Venice Beach boardwalk, a coat hanger that we duct taped to the side, some zip ties where we zip tied a web camera to the front, focused it back onto the pupil. And that allowed him to be able to draw again for the first time in 7 years. And that moment, that experience, watching that happen, and then the crazy things that started to happen afterwards because of that, was this kind of life-shifting moment for me that caused me to start Non Impossible Labs. And at the moment I made that decision, I got an email from the artist, Tempt, and he said, that was the first time I'd drawn anything for 7 years. I feel like I've been held underwater, and someone finally reached down and pulled my head up so I could take a breath. And I always joke that, you know, if you're deciding to or not to do something and someone sends you an email like that, do you really have a choice anymore? And so that was kind of the bing. That was that moment where it was like, all right, don't know what, don't know how, don't know what's going to look like, don't know what the revenue model is going to be. I don't know anything, but here we go. And that was, and I kind of just jumped off the cliff and started Non Impossible.
Well, you know, as Eric mentioned, you know, you're a complex dude. You've got a lot of hats to cover that head. And I feel like as I took a dive into Not Impossible, I got the same sense. It's sort of a multi-layered group of very, very smart, creative people. So can you give us a good sense of how would you describe it if you had, you know, if you had to, in a pretty succinct elevator pitch?
We are a group of kind of dreamers and kind of people that see social injustices, things that we call absurdities in the world, which is when you see something, you go, that's not right. It shouldn't be that way. Let's change it. It's not right that there was a dude who was paralyzed and he couldn't afford a Stephen Hawking machine. So we said, screw that. Let's get him a Stephen Hawking machine. It's ridiculous that there was a young boy who had both of his arms blown off and he was never going to have prosthetics because he couldn't afford prosthetics. We said, that's absurd. Let's figure out how to make 3D prosthetics for him. Like, so it's all a rebellion, a revolution against something that you see where you say, that's just not right. So our company is a bunch of people that see those absurdities and say, that's not right. Let's fix them. And then we build teams of brilliant people who help us solve those problems. So at our core, we're a bunch of producers and project managers who just have an uncanny ability of aggregating people way smarter than us towards a common mission of solving one problem. And then our goal, though, is by solving that one problem for one person, then we can scale it to help many people.
Mick, go internal for a minute and like refresh us on what you were thinking. You know, you see this guy Temp in the newspaper, I think you went to visit him and you just like blurted out like, hey, I'm going to help you. I'm going to fix some, you know, try to fix this or develop something. And, you know, so how do you go from, you know, most of us who are the passive kind of person looking at the newspaper and going, wow, that's a bummer, to saying, I'm going to, you know, build an iWriter. So it is, you know, that must have been a struggle internally, even if you're super motivated.
I think at a certain point, you have to be absolutely disgusted with the fact that people can look, that you as a person or the world can just look away from a problem and say, well, can't do anything, just put your hands up. So I think that that's kind of what happens to us, is we just reach this boiling point where of disgust, where we're like, we just can't step away from this. And once we do it, it's like red pill or blue pill. Once you take that pill and saying you're going to do it, your word is your bond, and we can't let up until we actually accomplish it. And I have to say, it tortures us. It absolutely tortures us, but not in a negative way. It drives us, right? It drives us to be able to just keep pushing forward when things get really tough. And they always, always, always get really tough.
Yeah. I mean, how many of these do you have going on at any one point? And let's back up pre-quarantine, if that helps. But I mean, do you have like 100 irons in the fire at any given point? Do you have people working on multiple projects? What does that look like?
It feels like 100 projects. But so our first project was the iRider. Our second big project was Project Daniel, which was about 3D. We launched the world's first 3D printing prosthetic lab in Sudan. Since that time, we've worked on different ways, different ocular recognition solutions, like the ones we did for Tempt with the iRider. We started creating a thing called Music Not Impossible, which is a way for that transferred the ability to, quote, hear music through the vibrations against your eardrum that gets sent to the brain. And then we actually use the skin as the signal receptor for music that would send a signal to the brain. So that was called Music Not Impossible.
And our friend Mandy Harvey, right, from No Barriers, was one of the subjects. She's a deaf musician, right? So she was one of the people you were working with.
Yeah. That. Mandy is not only an amazing friend, but she's such an amazing collaborator that it helped us refine how we interpret vibration so that it's meaningful for the deaf community to have that experience of music. We've got something that we're doing in the vaccine space. We've got something we're doing in Alzheimer's and dementia space. And our whole point is we'll go down these rabbit holes and we'll do it with corporate partners. We'll do it with partners that help us kind of fund it to that kind of final prototype phase, with the hope that then we can spin something off and turn it into a real company. And it's a tool that can really scale and help people. So I don't know if that answers your question.
What's your new project? Yeah, you did. What's your new project with the homeless and with hunger? I know that's a big thrust for you right now.
Yeah, so Hunger Not Impossible came about similar to that kind of level where we, you know, both of you know and have seen and read and heard and have been exposed to stats around hunger in this country, right? You might not be able to spout the stats off like I can right now because I study it all the time, but When I said that, you know, there's close to 50 million Americans that struggle to put food on the table every day, you might be like, yeah, that's right. I did see something like that. 1 in 9 kids are food insecure. You're like, oh, that's right. I did see or read something about that. I heard that. And I could start peppering off those stats to you. We just heard them one too many times. And we were like, this is ridiculous. Like how can a country, specifically, just look at our country, how can a country that is so blessed with food and it's an abundance of food, how can there be 60 million tons of food that goes to waste every year, yet people are still going hungry, right? How do we do that? What do we tackle? So we basically tackled it through we have a whole process called Help One, Help Many, where we focused on one particular person. In this case, it was a cohort of homeless kids in Venice Beach, where we live. And the thing that we did is we went to them and asked them, what is the one thing that you prize most? Food, clothing, water, shelter. Those were what we were expecting in a response. And their answer was their cell phones. And it was their cell phones because we were like, do they just like to play Tetris or Candy Crush or what's the deal? And they're like, no, it's a way for them to stay in communication with their community, to have a community that doesn't have a home. It's just a way for them to kind of be, quote, normal with the rest of the world and have access to what the rest of the world has access to. So we said, all right, what can we do? So we crafted, and this is 3 years ago, we crafted a very basic solution that's able to deploy. We give this to the charities, to the Boys and Girls Clubs, the YMCA, to Covenant House, whatever, schools, churches. They input the cell phone numbers of the people that they're trying to serve. It pushes them a series of text messages, because that way you don't have to download another app. It's just, you know, everyone uses text. And it allows a way to triangulate where they are and then push them to a healthy meal that they get to go and walk in and pick up for free and walk out. And the irony is we're pushing them to fast food restaurants. Now, we're not pushing them to fast food restaurants to try to give them diabetes or try to increase the obese population. We push them to McDonald's and they walk out with a chicken, a Southwest chicken wrap. We push them into Wendy's to get the raspberry chicken salad. We push them into Chipotle. Pretty much everything's good at Chipotle, but we actually are pushing people to better health outcomes, healthier meal choices, but ways that are convenient to them and are completely dignified. So the charity gets to feed their people. The restaurant gets to make a couple bucks, albeit discounted. But the person that walks in gets to, you know, claim a meal. And it's just, I'm just Mick. I'm not Mick the homeless kid. I'm not Mick the poor dad. I'm just Mick. And so we were working on this long before March and refining it, and didn't quite get the traction that we would like to have. We were always espousing it, but it just didn't quite catch on. Well, let's see. In a world with shelter at home, you know, mandates and restaurants that are closing and trying to create ways where you can't have large congregations of people, is there a better way than to fragment and disperse your supply chain by taking a cohort of people and putting them to a bunch of different places to pick up food, as opposed to congregating in one particular place? And so Hunger Not Impossible has just been taken off right now. And the beautiful thing about it is you can track and do everything from your laptop in your bedroom that you've been sequestered to, because you don't have to go out in the field. It all is happening through the cell phone. So we're pretty excited about it.
The thing that I'm fascinated in hearing is that, you know, you probably started with the core group based on your previous professional relationships, but then based on each of these issues that you identify as a group, do you collectively get together as you're sort of identifying the elements of the problem and say, you know, we could use a specialist here, somebody that's really knowledge-based here. And then you go out and recruit those people and then continue to bring and make your entire team bigger relative to each project?
The beautiful thing about, you know, if you think about the heritage of kind of where I came from, if you're going to make a science fiction film, you go out and hire a science fiction team to do that. If you're going to make they're going to do a period piece from the 1920s, then you hire a team that knows how to do that. So Horses for Courses, producers are used to hiring and staffing up around a particular need, right? And so we've just taken that way of thinking and created it so that if we're doing something in the Alzheimer's dementia space, great, let's go aggregate a bunch of brilliant people who make us feel stupid in that space. Oh, we're going to do some work in the Parkinson's space. Great. Let's get a bunch of brilliant people who have dedicated their lives to working in that space that are going to make us feel stupid over there. Where we act as that conduit is we don't care that we're not the smartest guy or girl in the room. In fact, we relish it, because sometimes knowing too much about something is what cuts your ability to foresee what new possibilities might be. So that rut that we get caught in with our quote expertise sometimes is a detriment and it is a liability. And we're able with our perspective to aggregate these brilliant people, but not let them get rutted because we refuse to have people tell us it can't be done. That's the only F word that you get in trouble for dropping at Not Impossible, is if you say you can't say the I word. That something is impossible.
So that kind of leadership is a bit rare, right? But I mean, you have to be vulnerable in that process, right? I mean, you have to be okay being the dumbest guy in the room in that expertise, right?
It's really hard to try to be the smartest guy in the room because someone's always going to be smarter than you. It's a lot easier to be the dumbest person in the room and really own that. That's for sure.
Talk about Project Daniel too, because we can't let you go without talking about Project Daniel. And we just have a few more questions because I know you got an appointment.
No.
So Project Daniel, just super powerful. I mean, you know, kid gets his arms blown off in Sudan. It's just an insane crisis.
Yeah. You know, with the iWriter, we found out about him. We were appalled at what was going on. We committed to helping him do it, invited a bunch of crazy people to our house. They stayed at our house for 2 weeks. We came up with a solution. We unveiled it. Boom. It worked. Not Impossible was born. So Project Daniel happened and we were like, all right, same ingredients. Let's do that thing again. We were repulsed by the fact that this kid would never have it. We invited a bunch of crazy people to our house expecting the same outcome. The difference was at the end of that period of time, we didn't have anything that worked because we were so cocky that we thought, well, we'll just rinse and repeat. We'll do the same equation. It could work all over again. Well, that wasn't going to be the case. So we had to.
And by the way, this is a kid, by the way, who was in his field, right? And he and these bombs go off. Their fields get bombed, and he hid behind a tree, right? And both his arms blew off.
Yeah. Sorry. The backstory on this is that just that there was a young boy tending his family's goats and cows in the middle of a field. His arms got blown off in this in this horrible bombing accident. And what kicked us in the gut was that when this kid woke up, he said, and he saw that he was a double amputee, the first thing he said was, "If I could die, I would, because now I'm going to be such a burden to my family." And to me, the concept that a 14-year-old boy's first response is now, is not "woe is me" or "poor me" or "what's my life going to be," but "what's my poor family." To me, that was just this moment where I was like, wait a second, we got to do something about this. So that was the commit.
So, yeah, now back.
Yeah, so that was the commit and figure it out moment. Assembled a bunch of people, nothing worked. Luckily, I flew in this guy who I'd read an article about who had 3D printed arms before. He taught me how to 3D print arms. And I mean, this is a hyper condensed version of this, but after overcoming all kinds of delays and obstacles and all kinds of just what you can imagine, I finally got into the refugee camp where he was located, and we set up shop and we created and launched the world's first 3D printing prosthetic lab. And this young boy was able to feed himself for the first time in 2 years. And it took every ounce of just drive and passion to get us to that finish line. And also every MacGyver trick you can imagine. We were using everything that we could just to make it work, but it eventually worked. So, and that was crazy.
Didn't he throw a ball too? Didn't you want him to throw a ball?
He threw a ball to us. He did, you know, there was a scene where he was using his new arm to keep a balloon up in the air and keep popping a balloon up in the air, which was pretty awesome. And it's pretty, and now, you know, this is a little known fact. We don't really talk about this tremendously, but about 3 years ago, do you guys remember the movie Argo? Remember how they
what's his face? Affleck.
Yeah, right. And he smuggled those people out. You guys want to plan smuggling them out? We may or may not have taken a lot of inspiration from that movie. And so I'll just fast forward to the fact that Daniel's no longer in Sudan, and he has now been going to school at private schools in Kenya now. And he speaks beautiful, fluent English. He has the equivalent now, I think, of a high school education. It's him, his brother, and his friend, his best friend, are all there. And they're just absolutely thriving in this world of possibility.
Hey, but you both have mentioned this earlier, but like now when you do these projects, you've got to have, let's say maybe not the first one, maybe not even Project Daniel, but now you're getting to the point where, you know, if you it's baked in to this, the development of the project. You know that if you take this one person, this one concept, this one thing that needs to be fixed, and you do it right, that it can be replicated.
One of our mantras that we live by here is help one, help many. So part of our design thinking, and I never used the word design thinking until years after someone told us, you guys have a process and that process is your design approach, is to really focus on that one person and blow it out for that one person, knowing that if we can solve it for that one person and then tell a really powerful story about that person, that's what gives rise to many people being helped afterwards.
So you're very motivational, right? You're a doer for sure. And how do you motivate people in COVID?
Let's just say that if you base this moment of COVID and you base that on a time continuum of the history of our planet, it probably wouldn't even get in a time lapse. It probably wouldn't even get a quarter of a second, right? So let's everybody just take a effing step back away. And let's put this into perspective, that this is going to be such a quick blip on the radar in terms of our species that we all need to keep that, you know, just keep ourselves in check. The question that I would ask everybody that you need to ask, be able to answer for yourself is, when this moment is over and the majority of us will be alive, did you do all you could? And if you can say, yes, I did all I could, and you can look at yourself in the mirror, then you did it. Then that's the only, you are the judge of your own value and of what you bring to the table. And if you're not able, if you don't have limbs, so you can't go build PPEs for someone or build things, great. What else can you do? Like if you're deaf, if you're blind, if you're in a wheelchair, if you're like, It doesn't matter. All that matters is you did everything that you could do and you didn't take no for an answer trying to get there.
That is a solid way to wrap it up, my friend, because that gets me fired up. I want to go out and hammer a piece of wood or something right now. Just get going and doing something. So.
I'm so motivated. I'm going to change out of my pajamas right now.
Dude, you're phenomenal, and you know, I'm not talking about you, Eric. I'm talking about Mick. Yeah, thanks so much for spending some of your time, because clearly after listening to you today and knowing what you do, you are a busy dude. You got a lot on your plate. So thank you for cutting out some time for us today. I know you've impacted a lot of people that are going to listen to this. So we really appreciate you.
Thanks, guys.
And I'll tell you, man, I mean, I knew a little bit about Mick before just from conversations you and I have had, but I really had no idea the depth and the scale and the talent that that guy brings to the table. And what I gathered from just listening to him, it was a privilege to be able to just listen to him. You can tell as he's speaking that this is a guy who eats, sleeps, drinks, breathes it, right? It's all consuming for him. And I love the fact that it seems like he is completely based. He's ingenuity based, right? Like it seems like he's just, his thread count is all about ingenuity. He sees a problem, and then through a creative collaboration and an aggregate of smart folks, which kept saying, you know, bring a bunch of people in and make me feel stupid. Like you reach a solution. You've known him for a while. So what did you learn differently today?
Well, what I learned today, you know, which was emphasized really strongly through that conversation, was he just stumbles upon this guy, Temp, in the newspaper. Right. Most people, you just go, oh, wow, what a bummer. I don't know what I can do about that. But he stepped up. He met him, and then he commits to going and doing something about this, to create this invention called the iWriter. So I think that's a cool message for people. Let yourself be compelled by the accidents that happen to us. Right. Like, this is not just a guy who's all into innovation. This is a guy who allows himself to stumble upon things that need to be solved in the world that give him outrage, and then use that outrage as fuel to go and make some progress in these areas. And I also love the idea that he's vulnerable, right? Like, he loves being the stupidest guy in the room. I think that's a super great trait, because most of us are too scared to be vulnerable, right? Like, it's my soapbox, but I love this thing called metacognition, this idea of what is it that I don't know? What are the things that I don't know? And so when you put yourself in that vulnerable position, you learn so fast. You surround yourself with incredible people, experts in that realm, and bam, solutions start popping out that are unexpected. So, but our summit will be people like Mick and incredible innovators, incredible No Barriers pioneers who are thought leaders, but also who have learned on the bleeding edge. So if you've liked our summits in the past, you've been a participant, you're going to love the virtual one, or maybe you're new to the summit and this is a great way for you to test out getting a little taste of this No Barriers life.
As usual, I learned a lot sitting down with you and a guest. So grateful for the whole process, and Mick is another great asset for all of us as we try to navigate this crazy landscape we're in.
But I also want to say thanks to Prudential and Wells Fargo, our two sponsors here for the podcast. And you know, if you love No Barriers, if you like the podcast, support the folks who support us, right? These are great companies. So thank you very much, and hey, No Barriers to everyone.
See you next time.
Production team behind this podcast includes senior producer Pauline Schaefer, executive producer Diedrich Jonk, sound design, editing, and mixing by Tyler Kottman, graphics by Sam Davis, and marketing support by Megan Lee and Carly Sandsmark. Special thanks to the Dan Ryan Band for our intro song, Guidance. And thanks to all of you for listening. We know that you've got a lot of choices about how you can spend your time, and we appreciate you spending it with us. If you enjoy this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe to it, share it, and give us a review. Show notes can be found at nobarrierspodcast.com. And soon they will be fighting.